Okay, good evening, everybody. Thank you so much all for coming. I really wasn't sure who would come or if anybody would come. And I want to thank Kovi Fleischman for thinking of having a shiur and putting it together and making the arrangements. And to thank Beit Knesset Hanasi for housing the shiur, for allowing us to have the shiur. And really, thank you to all of you for coming. I'm very touched and moved by the fact that so many of you are here. So because it is the 9 days and we are getting closer to Tisha B'Av, I thought that I would share some thoughts. You know, it's always a very emotional time. And I imagine that most of you are not gullus Jews like me. You know, there's a certain amount of guilt that comes with this time of year and that comes with being here at this time of year. So I wanted to share a couple of thoughts related to this time of year, related to maybe the proper attitude going into Tisha B'Av, or things to think about going into Tisha B'Av, which Be'ezras Hashem should be a Yom Tov this year. Is it going to be on Shabbos or Sunday if it's a Yom Tov this year? Still Sunday? Okay, so we'll have to, if it's a Yom Tov, I don't know. Okay, something to think about. I have to make a confession. I have one of my oldest childhood friends is here with us this evening, and he remembers me as a kid. And I could tell you that as a child, I was a little bit of an apikores. What I mean by that is, even before you knew me, Ellie, when I was in like first grade or so, maybe less, probably kindergarten or something like that, I had this terrible, terrible fear of Eliyahu HaNavi. You know, when the Seder came and my parents told me Eliyahu HaNavi was going to be coming, so I was like, I really don't want this stranger coming into my house stealing our wine, and I'm not interested. I want my friend Gavriel. Gavriel was my friend who lived like a block away. Let him come. I'll give him whatever wine he wants. I do not want Eliyahu HaNavi to be here. So I would panic. And thinking back, as silly as it sounds, but from an adult perspective, like, it makes a certain amount of sense. Like, why do we really want Eliyahu HaNavi? Meaning, all I knew is that he busted into your house and stole your wine and abruptly left. That doesn't sound like a great house guest. Whereas Gavriel would play Transformers with me, and you know, it was much more enjoyable. But when we're in the midst of observing days of mourning and sadness, with an emphasis on yearning for Mashiach and yearning for Yemosa Mashiach and the return of the Beis Hamikdash and Eliyahu HaNavi heralding the coming of Mashiach, you know, how often do we stop to ask, like, why is it exactly that we want Mashiach? Why is it exactly that we want Geula? How is the Beis HaMikdash going to make my life better, more meaningful, easier? We ask every day, Vashevis Havodot Dir Beisecha V'Yishe Yisrael, and on Shabbos we say, Yiratzon L'Vnech, Shetalenu B'Simcha La'Artzeinu, V'Sham Na'asel L'Vnecha, Es Karbonos Chavaseinu, Temidim Kisidram, Musafim Kulchasim, and Yom Tov. We say that we daven that we should be able to bring Karbonos. But do you realize, you take a step back and think for a moment, how much more challenging life is going to be on so many levels when there is a Beis HaMikdash? Meaning all Dinei Tum and Tahara are going to be practiced again, and there's only so long you'll be able to use plastic utensils before you realize that you need to get used to these laws, and you're going to need to figure out, like, what's tummy and what's tahor and how to take care of it, and what you're allowed to eat, what you're allowed to touch, who you're allowed to be near, what you're allowed to sit on, and all of those details. We're going to need to become familiar again with halachos of kachim. That's what the Chafetz Chaim famously pushed very hard for people to study Seder Kachim, because if you're really waiting for Mashiach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, according to some midrashim, the Beis HaMikdash can come down in a Shemaim, and it's going to land right there on Har HaBayis, and then we say, wow, that was awesome. Now what do I do with it? Meaning, how do I handle it? Is there anything that I can, how do I bring Karbanos? So we're going to have to brush up on all of that. And if you think Erev Pesach is stressful and busy now, wait till you have to bring a Karban Pesach on Erev Pesach. You know, Erev Pesach now is like a joke. You know, once the Sof Zman Achilus Chametz is over, so then, okay, there's nothing else to do. It's all pretty much set up. But that's when the action's going to start on Erev Pesach, when Mashiach is here. That's when we're really going to get going. We're going to see the Kohanim knee-deep in blood, the Mishnah describes, and it's going to be a whole balagan by Har HaBayis. I don't know, Israelis seem to be much more comfortable in, like, tight crowds than Americans are. They seem to, like, not be bothered by it, like a little bump here and there, like, but I don't know, from my American perspective, like, I like my space, you know? I don't know, it sounds like it's going to be a little bit much. And nowadays, after a long Yom Tov davening, we go home and we eat, and sometimes even rest, And imagine waking up to daven vasikin, only to then wait on an endless line at the Beis HaMikdash on a hot Yom Tov day to bring your olas ri'iyah and shalmei chagiga, you know, at the end of it all. And when Malchus Beis David returns, oh boy, if the king tells you to be somewhere at 7 a.m. and you make the mistake of showing up at 7:02 because you got caught behind a construction vehicle in your drive over, you're chayv misa for being married the malchus. Like then, it's over. So this is a pretty bleak picture. So I ask the question that so many times in Jewish history has really been unaskable, but in our relatively calm time in Jewish history, is Geula really going to be better than what we've already got? Is it something that we really... what exactly is it that we're looking for? What exactly is it that we're striving for? And to enhance the question, if the question really bothers us, then we're all apikorsim, right? Meaning one of the Yud Gimel Yikari Amuna is not only to believe that Mashiach will come, to believe in the possibility, but to actually yearn for it. It's the only one that requires not just believing something is, but actually doing something, not doing something physical, but actually proactively yearning for Mashiach. Brisker Rav famously pointed out, it's the only one of the 13 Ikari Emuna that isn't about believing something, it's about wanting something, it's about hoping for something. That achaka lo sheyavo. How can you yearn for something that's going to bring so many inconveniences with it? How can Hashem tell us what to want? You know, if I ask my kids to do something, and they say they don't want to do it, so I could say, I didn't ask you to want to do it. I asked you to do it, right? And then I say, when did I turn into my mother? But Akash Baruch Hu tells us this is what you're supposed to want, not just what you're supposed to do. So, in order to approach this question, I want to take a step back and take a look at Sefer Devarim, which we're starting this week. Sefer Devarim is fundamentally different than the rest of Chumash, primarily in the fact that it mostly is a recap of Moshe Rabbeinu's illustrious career as leader of the Jewish people. You know, that was it became the paradigm of leadership. You know, when the Chasam Sofer was born, Chasam Sofer was born on a Friday late afternoon. And the story goes that his mother went into, his mother was a big tzaddikah. She was known as, I forgot her name, but if it was Chana, she was known as Chana la tzaddikah. So if it was Rachel, she was known as Rachel la tzaddikah. She was a big tzaddikah, and she was known that way. And it used to be that there were Mekabel Shabbos in a lot of the northern areas. They'd have to be Mekabel Shabbos early always, or at least during the summertime, because it would be ridiculously late. Someone's from London, you spend some time in London, like in this time of year, if you Mekabel Shabbos at the regular time, it's very, very late. I remember Rav Shechter told us he was doing one of his summer trips that he gives into the Rebbetzin once a year, and he goes on a trip into a different place in Europe. And one year they were going to St. Petersburg, Russia. And I remember we were sitting together and in the OU office, and he realized that it doesn't really get so dark in St. Petersburg, Russia during the summertime. I've never seen him, I don't want to use the term freak out, but I've never seen him like so nervous and agitated, like, what am I going to do about Shabbos? When does Shabbos end? Meaning, if it never really gets to the point that says HaKachavim, does Shabbos really end? And then, like, there was, like, this wave of, like, comfort that came over him when he realized that Rav Itzla Petterberger lived in St. Petersburg. That's how he got the name Petterberger. So he said he must have figured it out. So there must be a Mahalich, and there must be a Minog already. When he goes, now all I have to do is figure out what Rav Itzla Petterberger did. But for us, you know, when we think of those things, we're not so worried about the end of Shabbos, we're worried about the beginning of Shabbos. I'm going to sit down and eat a meal at 11 p.m. So when the Chasam Sofer was born, he was born in a community where they always were Mekabel Shabbos early, around Plaga Mincha time, and his mother went into labor, like right before Plaga Mincha, and everyone was already gathered in the shul, ready to start Kabbalah Shabbos. She sent a messenger into the shul to ask the rabbi to stop the community from being Mekabel Shabbos, because if there's one shul in the community and they're Mekabel Shabbos, then everyone is bound by Shabbos. Now, it's true, a woman in labor is allowed to be Mechal Shabbos, but if you don't have to, so if you could control whether it's Shabbos or not, you know, the Gemara says that they used to be able to cheshbon exactly when you'll deliver based on when a woman would get pregnant, and that there were certain people that were makbid to not conceive on certain days because they're worried about delivering on Shabbos. So the Gemara says, okay, we don't make those cheshbonos anymore. The Gemara doesn't say because we can't really predict it anymore. The Gemara says because, you know, tam tiyem Hashem elokecha shomer psayim Hashem, you just go about your life normally and, you know, you hope for the best. But it's not ideal. So she sent someone in to ask that they stop. And the rabbi listened, and he stopped the whole shul. He said, everybody, we're going to sit and learn for a little bit now. I mean, a rabbi nowadays could try that once. That's it. Then he's out of a job. But they all sat and learned until the messenger came back and said the baby was born. Okay, so now Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos. Then they were Mekabel Shabbos. And the rabbi announced Mazel Tov to the Sofer family, to the Schreiber family. They have a boy, and they have to. And he announced the baby's name. He said, they're going to name him Moshe, because a boy born under such circumstances is going to be a leader of Klal Yisrael. And that's how the Chasam Sofer got the name Moshe. It wasn't a family name. It was a name of Moshe Rabbeinu. So pretty good guess, right? That he'd become a leader of Klal Yisrael. That's the story they tell. I have no idea if it's true or not, but that's the story they tell. So Moshe Rabbeinu had this illustrious career. He became the paradigm of leadership of Klal Yisrael. And there's, but in the first four books, you know, span many centuries. The final book, Dvarim, is written in just one day. And there's a significant amount of hidden rebuke that Rashi reveals to us in the Psukim at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim. It's Moshe Rabbeinu's, you know, last lecture, so to speak, but there's some rebuke that's not even hidden. It's direct and it's overt, and it's like bop you over the head kind of mussar. He recounts the story of the Chet HaMeraglim, and Moshe Rabbeinu goes into detail about the shortcomings of the nation at that time in history. And the Torah is very clear in Parshas Dvarim about what the nature of the sin of the Meraglim was. What did they do wrong? It was a lack of emunah. It's very similar to what it says in Parsha Shlach. It was a lack of emunah. They didn't believe. A very basic lack of emunah. Yet, elsewhere, the Torah identifies a totally different route for the Chet HaMeraglim. In Parshas Pinchas, when the Torah tells us about the Chet HaMeraglim, Rashi writes that Aval kol anashim, al anashim lo nigzra gzeres HaMeraglim. The women were not included in the gzera of the Meraglim, lefi shahayu mechavavos es haaretz. Because women loved Eretz Yisrael. The men lacked in their Avas Eretz Yisrael. The women did not lack in their Avas Eretz Yisrael. And the Torah in Parshas Shlach talks about Ha'aretz Asher Ma'astem Ba. When was there Ha'aretz Asher Ma'astem that you were disgusted by the land? That's talking about the Chet HaMeraglim. That there was a Mius Ba'aretz, that we were turned off, put off by the land. A failure to appreciate the land. And it's so interesting because in Tehillim, both of these Averos are described. In Tehillim, when David HaMelech has to encapsulate what exactly is the Chet HaMeraglim, he blames both of these shortcomings. Ve'yimusu be'eretz chemda and lo he'eminu lidvarecha. There was a mius ba'aretz and a lack of emunah. The question is, what does one got to do with the other? They're totally different things. One is, I don't believe that Hashem could, I'd love to be there, I just don't think Hashem could do it. Meaning, I come here every time, I'd love to live here, I just don't know how I'm going to make parnasa, I don't know how my kids are going to be successful, I don't know, I have a million questions and no one's guaranteeing me any answers, because you know in Chutz La'aretz all the answers are guaranteed, right? So I have no idea what the answers are going to be. So it's a lack of emunah, but it's not a mius ba'aretz. So what does one have to do with the other? What does a lack of emunah have to do with ma'astim ba'aretz? The accusation of being Moshe Rabbeinu is also a little bit misplaced. Doesn't seem fair. Because when the Meraglim came back, they said, it's an Eretz Avas Chalav Udvash. They said, have you seen the hotels there? They're beautiful. Have you seen like the Teulim you can go on and you walk around Yerushalayim at night and the cool breeze even in the summertime? It's fantastic. It's an Eretz Tova Ma'od. It's just that we're not going to be able to make it. And when Moshe Rabbeinu, even when Moshe Rabbeinu recounts the story of the sin, he says, Vayomru, they said, Tova ha'aretz asher Hashem Elokeinu nosin lanu, that it's actually a good land. So how can you say that there were moes ba'aretz? When Yoshua and Kalev respond to the Meraglim, they seem to emphasize the wrong point. They say, ha'aretz asher avanu ba'lesorosa tova ha'aretz ma'od. It's a very good land. It seems to be a claim that the Meraglim also agreed with. Like, why would they, if you're going to counter what they're saying, so say something against what their taina was. Their taina was the same thing back. And as we know, the Chet HaMeraglim is very important this time of year because it's the basis of Tisha B'Av. It was the first time that we did something terrible on Tisha B'Av, and the first time that Kodesh Baruch Hu decided that there's going to be a Bechiya L'Doros on this day. So there's some connection between Chet HaMeraglim and Churban HaBayis. So what we have to draw is a line that somehow connects Mius Ba'aretz, lack of Emunah, Chet HaMeraglim, which is both of those things, and Churban HaBayis. And how do those things all link up with each other? Because that's essentially how we got here, how we got to a point of having a Tisha B'Av. And then maybe when we understand that, we can go back to our original question, which is the question of what exactly is it that we're yearning for and that we're looking for, and whether our question is even a valid question to ask about, like, what is it that we want in terms of Geula. So Rav Pam in Sefer Atara LeMelech has a beautiful yisod. Rav Pam was like a very down-to-earth, practical kind of thinker. Rav Pam answers based on the Gemara Maseches Basra Daf Kuf Mem Beis. The Gemara tells us a halacha. So I'm going to ask if I'm going to do hashkafa or halacha tonight. So here's the halachic section of tonight. The Gemara tells us a halacha that I'm a zakalu uber lo kana. But let's say I want to give a baby gift to somebody, but I want to give it to the baby. I don't want to give it to the parents. I want to give a gift to the baby. Problem is, the baby's not born yet. But I could see the mother's pregnant. There's going to be a baby soon. So can I, I want to give an Israel bond. That's a good thing to do, right? I want to give an Israel bond to the baby. And it's in the baby's name, but the baby doesn't have a name yet. Okay, whatever, baby so-and-so. So this doesn't work. You can't be mezak anything to an Uber. You can't give anything. The baby can't make a kinyan yet. He's not here yet. It doesn't work. But the Gemara says that if one is mezaka to his own unborn child, then it does work. Then the kinyan is chal to his own unborn child. So how do we explain that discrepancy? Either the baby is bali olam or he's lo bali olam. How can you say that for he's not able to make a kinyan because he's lo bali olam? He's not a reality yet, and therefore he can't be kona. And vis-a-vis the parents, he is a reality, and therefore he can be kona. So the Gemara explains, because daito shel adam krova etzel beno, that a person's das is much closer to where his child is. What does that mean exactly? So Rav Pam explains, he quotes a gadol echad. I'm not sure who the gadol echad is. He doesn't say, he doesn't identify him. He says, if you think about who a baby is to an outsider, you know, it's a fetus. It's a big question mark. It's a big uncertainty. Labor is dangerous, and you know, will he be born at all? Will he come out healthy? Will he? The whole thing for the outsider is an afterthought. You know, how many people are coming for the Shabbos meal that we invited you to? If it's a pregnant woman, you don't say, you don't count the baby into the cheshbon. There's the mother. You don't view the baby as a reality yet. The entire pregnancy for the outsider is an afterthought. For the mother, going through the physical changes that she's going through and connecting with the unborn fetus in ways that are impossible for anybody else to understand, the baby's anything but an afterthought. The thought of the baby is dominating her existence that entire 9 months of pregnancy. It's all she thinks about. And even for the father, although it's a different experience, he's thinking about, you know, all his plans and dreams and how he's going to teach his kid how to play ball and how to read a Mishnah, or let's say that different, how to read a Mishnah and maybe how to play ball also, right? He's teaching about it. He's thinking about all the goals and the dreams and the aspirations. He's already envisioned, you know, the kid graduating from whatever medical school or Panovich or whatever your family bumper sticker is, you know, whatever it is that you're, you know, that you strive for and whatever your goals are. He's already, to him, the baby is a reality. And for that reason, the kinyan is binding. So Rav Pam points out that the message that emerges from that Gemara is that a cold, like, cost-benefit analysis, like plus-minus analysis, is something that is often tainted or enhanced or changed by an emotional connection. That when you think emotionally and you allow a fair amount of emotion to enter the picture, your assessment of the entire situation will change. Even with minor emotional connections, it could change, but certainly with a major emotional connection. You know, when I was in college, it used to be that you'd put on your exam, instead of writing your name, you'd write your social security number on some of the exams. And that was the worst, because then there's no point in, making the teacher like you. Like, I'm not going to bring the teacher a coffee every day if he doesn't even know it's me, right? Because but is he going to be dishonest anyway? He's not going to be dishonest, but he knows. You know, I pretty much know what I'm talking about, so give me the benefit of the doubt. The slightest little things, the slightest emotional connection will change the whole analysis. And the father of the child, he's aware, and the mother of the child, they're aware of the statistics and the potential difficulty in pregnancy. They're probably more aware than the stranger is, because they probably had those moments of, you know, those scary moments along the way that so often happen. But the love, the dreams, the hopes, the connection to the baby so outweighs that they're so energized by the prospect of the beauty of parenthood that they cannot focus on the genuine possibility of something going wrong, and the baby's already a reality. That, says Rav Pam, was the Chet HaMeraglim. The Meraglim saw how great the land was, and they acknowledged intellectually it was good. Tova Aretz, a cold assessment, it's nice, it's a good land. Their failing was in their inability to emotionally connect to it, to have it affect, to the point that they didn't allow their emotional connection to affect their judgment. And this is one of those places where one is supposed to allow their emotional connection. We're supposed to develop an emotional connection. We're supposed to feel a sense of Kedusha wherever we turn. You know, person, Rabbi Reisman, Rav Pam is probably his greatest Talmud, told us a couple of weeks ago, I brought some Talmudim there, and he told us that the first time Rav Pam went to the Kotel, he was so disillusioned. He was so upset because he saw that there were people just schmoozing with each other. Like, oh, what hotel are you staying at? How long are you here for? When do you go back? Like all the normal, you know, conversation. He's like, we're at the Kotel, and we really belong on the other side of the wall. And then how can we, like he was just overwhelmed by the Kedusha and he couldn't believe people were treating it like a normal place. When a person looks at Eretz Yisrael and coldly analyzes the benefits and the risks and does a cold calculation, you're never going to get to the right answer. You'll never arrive at the right answer. The right answer has to have emotion in it. The same way we love our spouses, even though they may do things that we occasionally find irritating, not my spouse, but everybody else's, then we shall allow our emotional connection to carry the day. The lack of bitachon was a direct result of mios pa'aretz. They said the lack of bitachon was because they were doing an analysis. They were doing a spy mission. But there was a mios pa'aretz. It wasn't disgust. It's better translated as failure to properly adore the land. And when Yerushua responded to the other Meraglim, he opens with a statement that tova aretz ma'od ma'od. Why does he say that? Not because they thought it wasn't good. The Meraglim also said that it was tova aretz, that the land was good. But Yerushua doesn't say that the land is good. He doesn't even say it's very good. He says it's very, very good. You see, if it were good, then a bad report is also acceptable. There's good and there's some bad. If it were very good, a bad report has to be taken into account. It could be tolerated. Oh, but if it's very, very good, then there's nothing to talk about. Then it's just something we need. There's no question. It's just how we do it. But we have to get there and we have to do it. If something goes wrong with one of our children, even if we're not sure exactly how we're going to handle the issue, giving up and abandoning the child is not an option. It's like, okay, this one didn't work out. Let's try again. No, you don't do that. Because there's love, because the child is yours, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu trusted you with the child. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said it could work with this child, so you take care of that child and you figure out what will work, how you can make sure that it'll succeed. And you see it all the time. I taught in high school for so many years. Parents who have that approach of, you know, it's not a question of assessing whether he did right or wrong. It's a question of how do I guarantee his success? Or how do I put him on the best path towards success? There's never guarantees for anything. But what can we do to make him successful? What can we do to make it work? And that's the entire assessment that it should have been. I think this idea of emotionally connecting is not only true of Eretz Yisrael, it's true of Ruchnius in general. It's true of spirituality. It's true of anything of Kedusha. A lot of times when it comes to Kedusha, you know, I was asked to give a talk to one of the groups on the NCSY Summer Kollel yesterday, a small group of five boys. So their madrich asked me to talk about how to gain a sense of Ahavas HaTorah. How does a person build a love for Torah? He said that's what the boys were struggling with. How do you love Torah? And it's such an important question to ask. It's such an important, because it's how to love Ruchnius. How do you love spirituality? Because that's the goal. You know, the Rambam has a fascinating discussion in the ninth parak of Hilchos Tshuva, where the Rambam says, you know, we know that the schar for mitzvos is often spelled out in the Torah. Torah tells us, you know, you do mitzvos and it's going to rain and your crops are going to be good and you're going to be successful and you'll win wars and things of that nature. So he said, but there's nothing in the Torah about Olam Haba. It doesn't say anything about it. And this is a major question. I think Klei Yakar has something like 15 answers to this question. Like, there's nothing in the Torah about Olam Haba. It's all about, like, Olam Hazeh. And the Rambam explains that all of the rewards we see in the Torah are really just there to tell us how HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to smooth the path for us toward greater Ruchnius. The goal is always Olam Haba. The goal is always greater Ruchnius. But you know what? It's a little bit easier to learn when you're not distracted by living in a war-torn area, when you're not starving, when you're not, you know, it's a little bit easier to do mitzvos when you're able to focus on the mitzvos and you don't have other things. The rewards aren't the rewards. The rewards are the ability to gain more ruchnius, and that's really the ultimate reward. Meaning the Rambam is teaching us that a person has to develop a taste for things that are truly valuable. Rav Yehuda Goldberg pointed out something that I thought was amazing, an amazing Dvar Musar. He pointed out, I'm sure this Nismichas Chavar people here, you've heard this. He pointed out that there's a halacha. I was just in the cemetery this morning, and the halacha is that you're supposed to tuck your tzitzis in the cemetery, because it's loig l'rush. It's mocking the dead. They're not able to do mitzvahs. So they're not able to do mitzvahs anymore. So you don't want to mock them that you're still able to do mitzvahs and they're not. So you tuck in your tzitzis. So Rav Yehuda Goldberg pointed out, you know, there's no halacha anywhere that when visiting a cemetery that you're not allowed to fly your private jet and land on the runway right next to the cemetery and walk in with your custom-made suit and your Rolex and you know, have your driver open the door for you, and there's someone dap your sweat, you know, and your Beit Shemesh is sweating. And there's no halacha like that, no halacha whatsoever. Well, why is there not? Isn't that loig l'rush? Also, look at you living it up. Because the mason know what's really valuable and what's not. They know that you're being a fool if you think that those things are valuable. They're not jealous of you; they're laughing at you. If you're flying in your private jet and you're wearing your Rolex and you do, they're laughing. You think that's important? That's what you're chasing? That's what you're spending your whole life going after? Don't you realize that if you have a taste for ruchnius, for kedusha, you have a sense for what ruchnius can mean, that should be what you're chasing your entire life. And the Rambam is teaching us this idea of developing a taste for finer things. You know, I have a very close friend who to this day, he's 47 years old, and all he eats is hot dogs, chicken nuggets, noodles. That's his diet, period. Hot dogs, chicken nuggets, noodles. 9 days, noodles, right? That's his diet. That's the whole thing. And like he goes to, he's a very successful attorney, and he goes to like fancy events and his, you know, all these nice weddings where they have all this fancy food, and like he'll always ask for the kiddie menu. And like, it's a little bit sad, no? Because he's never going to appreciate how delicious, I don't know, sushi is, or maybe not everyone's a sushi person, or a steak is, or he's just never going to appreciate like the finer things in life, which, you know, are really delicious. And that, says the Rambam, is our avoda, not from a gashmius perspective, from a ruchnius perspective. The avoda is to appreciate ruchnius, to appreciate, to come to a sense where that's what we strive for, that's what we want. One of the Ikari Amunas to yearn for Yemos HaMashiach. How can Hashem tell us what to want? Hashem is telling us how to train ourselves to enjoy closeness to Hashem, where that our avoda is to train ourselves to enjoy closeness to Hashem, which admittedly is an acquired taste. It doesn't come easily. I don't know many people that walk into a room, see a sefer on a table, a chumash on a table, a gemara on a table, and say, chalashim for that sefer. There are people like that, but not many. That's just like, but once we sit and learn, we enjoy it, and we come to an appreciation of the benefit of it, and how, you know, you walk into a kid walks into a candy store and he's chalashing for it, but to try to build that sensitivity to get to that point where it's something that we're looking for, that's what it means to yearn for Yemos HaMashiach. But if we spend our lives caught up with every stupidity that society has to offer, and we never develop that taste, that love for the finer things in spiritual life, then we end up like the person who's invited to the finest restaurants and says, "Do you have a kiddie menu? You have a hot dog? You know, maybe the little ones in blankets, something like that." And he's laughed at and mocked that the world's finest chefs don't have a kiddie menu. And that's what Yemos HaMashiach is. We're going to open up a newspaper in Yemos HaMashiach. Front page will be a shir that the Melech HaMashiach said. That's the front page of the paper. Do you want to read it, or do you say, yeah, click, you know, scroll down to the next story? And the next story is going to be more ruchnius, and it's going to be more. And that's the idea, to appreciate ruchnius, to come to an emotional connection with the Ribbono Shel Olam. So we observe Tisha B'Av to mourn the loss, not of a building per se, but a chance at Kirvas Elokim, at closeness with the Ribbono Shel Olam. I have to say, each visit to Eretz Yisrael, again, I don't know all of you, and I don't know how many of you live here and how many of you are visitors. like me, but each visit to Eretz Yisrael causes a person, a thinking person, a sensitive person, to question, like, did I really develop a sense for Ruchnius? And if I did, then why isn't the magnetic pull stronger? Because isn't this where Ruchnius happens? Isn't it where it's so much easier? I was talking to a very big Talmud Chacham recently, and he said, I mean, I'm afraid to even say the word, he said, there are no Gedolim in America. I was like a little taken aback. He said, it's just a different madrega. The way a person can grow in Torah learning. I would take, you know, I object to that on a, you know, not so many counts, but on a couple of counts. But the way a person can strive and grow is built for it. This is the land that's built for it. And our avoda throughout life is to develop that sense for Ruchnius. And that's why when we're here and when we come here, we have to continue to build that way. So I hereby publicly declare my jealousy of all of those of you who are zocha to live here. And Bezer Hashem, we should all be zocha to reap those benefits and appreciate them as benefits when Mashiach comes. B'karov b'meherav yameinu. There was a suggestion that we open the floor to questions. I don't know if I can answer any questions, but if anyone has any questions. Happy to. No? Oh, sorry. Let me see. Yes.
Thank you so much.
So it's a big machlokas haposkim, whether Tisha B'Av is actually Shabbos and Yud B'Av is just the day Tisha B'Av observed, or Tisha B'Av actually gets transferred to Sunday. Big nafkaminas, is this week Shavuot Shechal Bo Tisha B'Av? Right? Meaning if Tisha B'Av is really Shabbos, then this week is Shavuot Shechal Bo Tisha B'Av. And we'd have a lot of chumras, meaning we'd have many more restrictions or less room for leniencies on the 9 days halachos. Other nafkaminas are Dvarim Shebetzina, whether we're knowing Dvarim Shebetzina on Shabbos. It happens to be that there are like 8 nafkaminas, and they're not consistent in terms of how we paskin, so it's a little bit hard to say. Normally we would say, no, the spiritual qualities, you know, the previous day is endowed, the day it was supposed to be is endowed with those spiritual qualities. We have to be Noheg on, you know, on the other day, but with Tisha B'Av it's unique, because the Gemara says that that one of the Amoraim said that had I been there when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, I would have made it on Yud Ba'av, because that's when the Beis HaMikdash really burnt. It wasn't on Tisha B'Av. It was late in the afternoon Tisha B'Av that the fire started, that the burning started, and most of the Beis HaMikdash was actually physically turned to rubble on the 10th day of Av. So it could be that in a nod to that Shita, when Tisha B'Av falls on Shabbos, Tisha B'Av was actually instituted to be chal on Yud Ba'av. There is a line of thinking of several achronim, though, that even when it comes to other days, let's say Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galios, that Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galios does take on inherent status of Kedusha. That it's not just Minogav Sein B'Yadeinu does not just mean that we're observing a practice because we have to observe it, even though it's not really the quality of the day. So there is a line of thinking that that the Rabbanan have that kind of capacity. You know, there's a concept that certain times the Rabbanan have the ability to mold the Torah, which is difficult to understand, but Chachamim have sometimes the Torah gives the right to the Chachamim to come up with the details of a halacha, like the Gemara says, by Melechas Chalamoed. You're not allowed to do Melechas Chalamoed. What is Melecha? So the Rabbanan had the right to decide, well, a Melechas Tavar Aved is not Melecha, and other things are Melecha. And they figured out exactly what a Melecha is and isn't. They have the right to mold the Torah. So it could be they had the right to imbue Kedusha in a day. So I'm not sure, meaning other than those Nafkaminas, you know, I'm not sure what the Nafkamina is, but yeah, that's Machlokas. Always the best answer. It's always the safest answer in Judaism. Yeah.
Well, thank you for the share.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if you think all Jews today should live in Israel.
If I think all Jews today should live in Israel. I know that would be disingenuous if I... it's a hard question because, you know, from a global perspective, of course all Jews belong in Israel. But then when you get down to the nitty-gritty and you go on an individual level, it's hard to say that each and every individual, that it's the best decision for them and their family, always. I think all Jews should have a plan to live in Israel. It's not always that now is always the best time. There are times where it's a little bit more challenging. Again, a very controversial statement. I was talking to an Adam Gadol recently, who told a group of friends and myself that when, you know, that at a certain stage in life, I'm not even going to identify the stage. he said, don't come, wait till you're past this stage in life, or come before this stage in life, because the price is too heavy to pay in terms of the from kind of the family and the disruptions to family life. So there is such a thing as the right time, but I think very often we're not good at assessing what the right time is. Because we know that we have that idea that there's not always the right time. So us Golos Jews tend to say, we tend to always think that that it's never the right time. I liken it to sometimes when I deal with young couples and they're nervous about starting a family. So sometimes when they get married, right off the bat, they're not ready to start a family for whatever reason, emotional reasons, physical reasons, whatever it is. But once you have that Pesach, then it's like, yeah, but also I need to finish medical school and residency and fellowship. So when I'm 42, I'll be ready. It could be never ending when we make that kind of assessment. But you have to be blind. You know, Rabbi Yisrael Reisman told us a couple of weeks ago, like, you have to be blind not to see Kibbutz Galios, right? Meaning, what's happened here since 1948, like, every decade has brought, like, a massive, massive influx from a different part of the world of Jews, from Russia, from Ethiopia, from, you know, it's just, you have to be blind not to see Kibbutz Galios. You see what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is doing. And as a dear friend of mine who made Aliyah once told me right before he made Aliyah, he said, no galus has ever ended well. We never had a galus that really ended well. So you're just waiting for that? It's a good kasha. Yeah.
Related a bit to that, could be that it's just me, or but I assume some people here feel the same way. One thing here that might be lacking in a certain sense is community shuls or community culture, rabbanim, things like that. I think partially because there's such a global community, meaning throughout the whole country with all the people, like that feeling of we're in this together, but that trickles down to the fact that the role of a rav and the role of a shul is very different here, generally speaking, than it is in the States. So right. How could we make up for that, so to speak, if we don't find that we have a rav here or a community here in that same sense?
Right. So, I mean, the question assumes that that's an ideal, meaning that the Chutz La'aretz model is an ideal. I will say this for sure. It is definitely, definitely an ideal to have a Rebbe or a Rav in your life that you trust, that you can go to, that knows you, that knows your family, that that is on the same wavelength as you, and that is, I can't even begin to, you know how many times I speak somewhere and I talk about, just it comes out. I talk about my Rebbe telling me this or my Rebbe telling me that, and people come over to me with like tears in their eyes. I don't have a Rebbe. How do I get a Rebbe? Meaning, where? It's a real valuable relationship. You know, much like a person who's, let's say, an only child doesn't know what it means to have a sibling, so they're missing out. They're missing out on a certain relationship that they just don't have. Not having a Rebbe is a real relationship that you're just, but that's in your control. You can't make siblings, right? But you can make yourself a Selech Rav. So to have a Rebbe, to have a Rav that you trust and that you can talk to and that you can ask not only halacha questions to, but halacha questions to also. And very often halachic and emotional and just hashkafa questions are all melded together. They overlap with each other a lot. That's critically important for everybody. It happens to be that in Chutz La'aretz there's more of a model to allow that to happen within a community setting. And over here you don't have it as much. So it's probably not a bad idea to start building, and I see that happening sometimes. Rabbi Rosner has a following of people who are Rabbi Rosner people, and they're Talmidim of his, and they, like, you do see it happening in certain places. I was just by Rabbi Chaim Eisenstein yesterday also, like, they have, like, so, like, on Yom HaTzimut, Rav Schechter spoke in yeshiva, and someone said, like, but in Eretz Yisrael, everything's so extreme. So he said, so all you normal people should go, and the whole thing will be normal, and everything will be, so, meaning there has to be some sort of influence from all the Olim to, you know, there's so many things that are so much better about Israeli society, and so many things that are, a few things that might be a little bit better about American Judaism. So we should learn from each other, and we should, you know, incorporate some of the things over here as best as we can. And until that time, then asei lecha rav. You have to go out of your way to make sure that, which you do very, very well. But you have to asei lecha rav. Absolutely. Yes. Pleasure. Increase the yearning for Mashiach. So I'll tell you, my answer probably would have been different a few hours ago, but this afternoon I listened to an interview that my friend Rabbi David Bashefkin did with Mirlana Morris, the mother of Dani Morris, who was killed in Meron. And she said something that, like, just like, hit right, many things that hit right at the heart. If you want something to do on Tisha B'Av, by the way, listen to that. You're going to have to pause it many times just to stop and cry and internalize, and, you know. But one thing that really got to me was she said that for her, the biggest trigger is Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim. That every time she's at a wedding and she hears Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, and she's looking around and she's thinking that other people are thinking, oh, we're at a wedding. If they're thinking about the words at all, they're thinking, oh, it would be nice to have a Beis HaMikdash or whatever. And she's thinking, I just want my Dani back. And, you know, all the relationships, all the connections, you know, I want to be able to connect with the people that I love. And I think to just zoom that out a little bit, and you think about just, you know, if there's someone that puts out, maybe Yesh HaTorah puts out, like, every year, like, a list of the tragic things that have happened in the past year. And every year is ripe with tragedy. And you think about that, all of that is a function of Churban. Meaning it's very real. It's not like, you know, up in the air. It's like all of that is a function of Churban. Even if Ein Ben Olamazel Yimosu Mashiach Ala Shibul Malchus Bilvad, even though we paskin that way, but that means Shibul Malchus. That means that we're going to live in peace in our land, and that's something we can connect to, even if we're not fully tapped into what it means to bring a karbon, which is very hard for us to tap into. But that we can hopefully tap into. I think that's what people it's become the thing on Tisha B'Av, that people talk about all sorts of tragedies. Someone once complained to me, Tisha B'Av is about the Beis HaMikdash, not about the Holocaust, not about all these other tragedies. But yes, it is. It's about all the tragedies. It says it in the keynotes that it's about all the tragedies. It's about everything. So try to tap into the saddest things you've ever experienced in your life and realize that sadness wouldn't be there if we had Geula. Works for me. Yeah, so that's a much longer process, meaning to actually look forward to the Beis HaMikdash. Really, Chafetz Chaim was right, meaning you really need to learn about it. And without learning about it, I don't know. Maybe there are some people that are more spiritually sensitive and have, like, some sort of special gene that automatically connects them. But I find that when you learn about what happened, is then especially if you go in the places, like, you know, you walk the path where they would walk the Siyul HaZazel, and, like, you realize... I think that, you know, maybe that's just me because, you know, I enjoy learning, but I think that when you learn Kachim, you learn about even the Kachim Sugis in Moed, you learn about just what actually happened. And I think it's worthwhile thinking about, like, that Avodas Hashem nowadays is really a shell of the potential of what it could be. Like we said before, Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach, we're missing the whole thing. We're missing the whole ikar. Everything. Matzah is to complement the. I mean, matzah. Maror is to complement the Korban Pesach. Matzah also complements the Korban Pesach. Everything is built around the Korban Pesach, and we're missing the whole thing. We're missing the main components of our Avodas Hashem. So a person develops a sense of Avodas Hashem, and you don't want the Shechinta Begalus anymore. You want the Shechina to be there. Rabbi Reisman told us that when he was with. He used to come every summer. He still comes every summer to Or Sameach. And he, but on Shabbos, he said when he's been coming every summer since 1997. He said when Rav Eliashiv was alive, he used to go to his Gemara Shir. It's Rav Eliashiv's Gemara Shir on Shabbos, and they were mechabidim because he's a Rashiv of America. They sat him right next to Rav Eliashiv. And during Shmone Esrei, he said Rav Eliashiv was hard of hearing, so he would daven loudly because he has to be mashmiya lazna. So he said, the only way to daven if you're standing next to Rav Eliashiv is if you're davening along word for word with him. It's like if you stand next to Rav Shechter, it's similar. You have to daven word for word with him. The only thing is with Rav Shechter, it's like painfully slow. It's like really, really hard to keep up with him and to slow yourself down that much. It's so intense. The whole Shmone Esrei is so intense every time. With Rav Eliashiv, he said it was like Kadama Medaber El Chaveru. It's like he was talking to a person. He's davening pretty quickly. And then, for three words, every single time, three words, he slowed himself down and got really intense. And he didn't know anyone was listening in. But three words every time. Hamachzir shchinaso l'tzion. Every time. He would just like get really intense. So Reisman says, Stam, it's a good eitza. Meaning, we always wake up at modim, right? So wake up a little earlier. You know, wake up at hamachzir shchinaso l'tzion. You know, so that's a good idea. But to see that there's that sense of yearning for, so we were talking about before, that yearning for Kedusha, that yearning for Avodas Hashem. Yes. Yeah, so belief is a very tricky thing because it's obviously not an on-off switch. It's obviously not a yes or no. There's obviously a wide range of levels of belief that could be, you know, what does it mean to work on your emunah? Do you believe? So you believe. So what is it? Now, obviously, there are many, many madrigals, and this actually causes a lot of people trouble. I spoke to a therapist recently who's dealing with a student who's a yeshiva boy, who has OCD, and he's always concerned that he's not bikores. I have a Talmud like this. He said, Rebbe, I touched somebody's wine, and I think I'm an apikores because I sometimes, it's an OCD thing, meaning, but because he has doubts that sometimes creep into his mind, so mele, I must be an apikores. I had a Talmud once, who when he was in elementary school, he had a boy in on the bus or something or in his class that bullied him relentlessly. He was very badly bullied in elementary school to the point where when he was in like fourth or fifth grade, he went home one day and he davened that the boy should die. And the boy actually died. And he's in therapy now because he's always thinking, you know, what if I think a negative thought about somebody? You know, then lightning come down in a shemayim, and that's like a tefillah. That meaning, even what a tefillah is, and what it's very, very tricky. So really, you have to think about like I don't think there is a particular meaning. It's natural that people have certain doubts about certain things at some points in their life. I'm not sure exactly where to draw the line, but I think a lot of the avoda is to recognize that we're human and human beings think about things, but we maintain a basic sense of equilibrium with some ups and downs. So my friend Rabbi Yechiel Webman always says that, I think he heard from Rav Avram Shor once, that if you look at an EKG machine, right, if there are ups and downs, that means you're living, right? If everything is straight, if everything is consistent, then that's not a good sign, right? That's a sign of death when it's a flat line. So life comes with ups and downs, but it's good to, you know, be around a certain line where that line is, you know, involves a minute. But I'm not sure exactly how to answer that question. Okay. Erev Tov, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. Do we have interest in a minion from Arav by any chance? Yes. Okay.
Just before we close up,
thank you very much. Thank you very much.